From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Federal marshals and a former FBI agent speak out about racism within law enforcement, and a conversation with author David Bradley about the bondage hypothesis, a meditation on race, history, and America. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Injured Haitian immigrant Abner Louima is recovering from another round of surgery in New York. His lawyer says doctors removed a bowel obstruction last night. The obstruction was a complication resulting from earlier surgery to repair Louima's battered body. Police allegedly sodomized Louima with a wooden stick in a Brooklyn precinct in New York. That prompted plans for a protest march in New York today. Organizers hope the march across the Brooklyn Bridge into Manhattan will draw 100,000 people or more. We'll have more on that story coming up. 10 days of flight tests have bolstered the theory that it was a mechanical malfunction that brought down TWA Flight 800, though what triggered it still remains a mystery to investigators. Many more tests aimed at pinpointing the cause of the blast are scheduled for the next 6 months. This according to Bernard Loeb, Director of Aviation Safety for the National Transportation Safety Board. Columbia HCA Healthcare Corporation, beset by a federal probe for allegedly cheating Medicare, now also faces inquiries into overbilling of health programs for the poor in 10 states. Investigators in Arkansas, Kentucky, Massachusetts, Nevada, Utah, Washington, and Wyoming told the Associated Press this week they're examining whether the company overbilled state Medicaid programs. More than a quarter of the 32 states that host Columbia hospitals have begun inquiries into the nation's largest publicly traded hospital chain. Alabama, Florida, and Texas officials confirmed their inquiries in those states earlier this month. Mitsubishi Motor Corporation has settled a lawsuit with 27 women who'd accused the company of condoning sexual harassment in the workplace. Two of the original 29 plaintiffs did not participate in the settlement involving the Japanese automaker's plant in Normal, Illinois. Mitsubishi promised to donate $100,000 to women's causes in the Bloomington-Normal area, the two sides said at a news conference yesterday. They would not disclose any other details of the settlement, but an attorney for the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission said it involved substantial cash payments to the women. The District of Columbia has reportedly reached an $8 million settlement with jail workers who allege they were sexually harassed. The Washington Post says hundreds of former and current Department of Corrections employees will benefit from the settlement reached yesterday. The seven women and one man who filed the original suit in 1994 accused the department of tolerating demands for sexual favors and reprisals for those who refused or complained. The suit later was made a class action. This is a piece on the front page of the Washington Post today. It says the victims were young and mostly female, judged to be rebellious or promiscuous, of low intelligence or perhaps of mixed blood. One was a young woman whose priest believed she had not learned her confirmation lessons well enough, another who couldn't read a blackboard because she didn't have eyeglasses and was deemed to be retarded. In the eyes of Swedish authorities, they were misfits in a forward-looking nation, and for that they paid a terrible price, sterilization at the hands of the state, often against their will. From 1934 to 1974, 62,000 Swedes were sterilized as part of a national program grounded in the science of racial biology and carried out by officials who believed they were helping to build a progressive, enlightened welfare state. Now, the collective history of the victims, brought back into public view by a sharply written series of articles in Sweden's largest morning newspaper, has stirred the public consciousness of a country that's often ignored the darker corners of its past. Meanwhile, this news from Texas. In response to a new crackdown on illegal immigration along the Texas border, Mexican consuls from throughout South Texas met yesterday and warned the policy may lead to human rights abuses. Border crackdowns in populous areas shift the immigration flow to more deserted regions where immigrants' rights may not be protected, this being charged by Mexican officials. More Border Patrol agents are now on duty in downtown Brownsville, Texas, and along a 2.5-mile section of the Rio Grande south of downtown. This news from Algeria. Attackers massacred at least 300 Algerian villagers, slitting their throats, decapitating many of them, and then burning their bodies in the worst such attack since the Islamic insurgency began 5 years ago. This according to the villagers. The attackers placed the decapitated heads of some of the victims on the doorsteps of their homes in the village of Race, located in the southern suburb of Sidi Moussa, where the overnight attack took place. An Associated Press reporter arriving at the scene this morning saw at least 100 bodies lying in the streets. But villagers, speaking on condition of anonymity for fear of reprisals, said at least 300 had been killed. And a top Russian nuclear official today dismissed U.S. suspicions that Moscow carried out an underground nuclear test, saying a tremor in the north was the result of an ordinary earthquake. The tremor was a magnitude of 3.5. And that's some of the news at this hour. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Today in New York City, thousands will be marching to protest the police beating and torture of a Haitian immigrant earlier this month. The march, which is drawing people from all over the United States, is expected to be the largest demonstration against police brutality in the city's history, if not the country. If nothing else, today's march illustrates the revulsion and outrage that many in New York and across the country feel about the torture of 30-year-old Abner Louima. U.S. Attorney Zachary Carter called the incident an act of incomprehensible depravity. In the early morning hours of Saturday, August 9th, outside a New York nightclub, police arrested Abner Louima, apparently mistaking him for another man who'd been involved in a fight. Louima and local prosecutors charged that police threw him into a police cruiser and then beat him repeatedly. The police then took him to the local precinct, where they shoved a bathroom plunger up his rectum, tearing his colon and bladder. Officers then forced the bloody and dirty plunger into Louima's mouth, breaking his teeth. Throughout the ordeal, officers verbally abused Louima with racial epithets and denounced his accented English. The latest stories say that it may not have been a toilet plunger, but perhaps a mop handle or a broom handle. Four police have been arrested and charged in connection with the case. Originally, police officers sought to cover the case up, both at the precinct and the local hospital, but for the perseverance of one nurse, Magalie Laurent, who we spoke to on Democracy Now!, they very well may have been successful. Well, right now, we're going out to Brooklyn, where the march is gathering. Marchers are gathering, and they're going to be marching over the Brooklyn Bridge. We're joined right now by WBAI Pacifica reporter Dave Sears. Hi, Dave. Can you hear us?
Yes, I can hear you fine, Amy.
Well, what is the scene like right now in downtown Brooklyn?
Well, within the past half hour, I'd say the crowd has swelled to well over 1,000, perhaps 2,000 or 3,000 are now gathered here in Grand Army Plaza. It's a very diverse crowd, which I think represents how far-reaching this issue is. It cuts across all racial and ethnic boundaries, certainly. There are contingents from ACT UP and from anti-police brutality groups in New Jersey present. They're expecting people from as far away as Miami to attend the march today. The march is scheduled to leave Grand Army Plaza at about 10:30. They've given a long time for people to gather and get organized. It's very tightly organized and controlled. They have many marshals who are helping to keep the crowd under control and to keep the peace here. It's not a tense crowd, certainly. There's a large police presence, but most of the police officers that are visible are dressed in NYPD community affairs uniforms. They're light blue shirts, and there aren't too many guns and nightsticks present. The most remarkable thing, I think, at this point is the amount of media coverage. So many of the demonstrations like this that have been held in New York City and in other areas around the country have gotten scant media coverage, but today the media is out in force. The helicopters that are flying overhead are mostly news helicopters, and the television coverage is extensive.
You know, Dave, there is a tradition in the Haitian American community of very large demonstrations. In 1989, one of the largest demonstrations in New York was held by the Haitian American community protesting the Center for Disease Control's policy, saying that Haitians couldn't contribute blood because of AIDS. Then hundreds of thousands marched over the Brooklyn Bridge, closing it down. And again, this is an effort of being organized by the Haitian American community.
This is indeed an effort that is being organized by the Haitian American community, but it is also an issue that does cut across many boundaries. One interesting aspect of it is that a contingent of at least 400 Dominicans are expected to come down from Washington Heights. Dominicans and Haitians share the island of Hispaniola, and there has often been tension between the two groups, but there is unity among them at this time. And I think what is significant here is that with the size of the Haitian community, the number of demonstrations and rallies that have taken place that have united the community, with the exception of perhaps the CDC demonstration, have been relatively small, but this has certainly united many people within the Haitian community, and as I said before, well beyond that.
Well, Dave, I want to thank you very much for joining us. We'll keep our listeners updated on what's happening. Some stations will be airing this after the march takes place, but it's significant that 3 hours before the march is expected to move on to City Hall, there are already thousands of people in downtown Brooklyn. Dave Sears, WBAI Pacifica reporter on the scene in Brooklyn. Thanks for joining us. We're also joined right now by Juan Gonzalez, my co-host and columnist with the New York Daily News. Before we move on to some other people who will be at the protest today, it might surprise some federal marshals not there to watch the crowds, but there to participate in the protest. Juan, you've done some very interesting pieces this week on the reaction of authorities in New York to the beating of, or police torture of, Abner Louima. Your first piece was about the task force that Rudolph Giuliani, the mayor of New York, set up in response to what happened.
Well, yes, Amy. What I've tried to do is, because unfortunately these incidents which have been occurring for so many years in this city and many cities across the country, there's a tendency on people's part to forget the past. And I just attempted in one column to remind the readers of the Daily News of Mayor Giuliani's own personal history and his consistent opposition to any kind of public oversight of police abuse cases. And so I attempted to say that this task force is so unusual, I think primarily because this incident happened a few months before an election in which the mayor had everything sort of in hand to roll to victory, and suddenly this unexpected incident occurs. And so he felt it necessary to turn against the very police department that he has so often defended and refused to allow any kind of public oversight, and that this particular panel is so unusual, uncharacteristic of his whole history of relationship to the police department.
But task force aren't unusual for politicians who want to put off an issue.
Because there have been so many. The Mullen Commission gave excellent recommendations on what needed to be done in the police department, and the mayor has consistently refused to implement any of those recommendations, even firing Walter Mack back in 1995 when Mack wanted to establish a 24-hour hotline.
And Walter Mack was?
He was the head of internal affairs for the police department at that time, and he wanted to establish a 24-hour hotline so that the public could, on police abuse, so that the public could call at any time. Officers specifically geared to that issue. That was a recommendation of the Mullen Commission. The mayor forced him out because he wanted to implement that. We've heard about how the early calls in the Abner Louima case to internal affairs were mysteriously disappeared, any logging of them. If there had been a 24-hour hotline dedicated to the police abuse, maybe this might not have happened.
Well, you particularly focused on journalists who were appointed by Mayor Giuliani to participate in the task force and were quite scathing about their participation.
I think it's outrageous for journalists to participate in a panel of this type. In my 20-odd-something years in journalism, I've always been told by my editors that you do not write about issues that you have a direct vested interest and you are participating in. And here you had Stanley Crouch, a columnist with the New York Daily News, Felipe Luciano of WLIB and Fox Television, and Eric Brendel, the editorial writer for the New York Post, all participating in these panels. And not only that, but it's occurring 3 months before an election. So you're, in essence, participating in something that has a political nature to it, a content to it. So I thought it was outrageous for my colleagues to lend themselves to this kind of activity.
Your second piece, which appeared in yesterday's New York Daily News, was headlined "For Victims and Cops Alike, It's Still a Dream." I quoted in the news headlines earlier U.S. Attorney Zachary Carter calling this, you know, just a terrible outrage what had happened to Abner Louima. But you sort of tell a different story of his history, as well as other federal authorities dealing with police brutality.
Yeah, these federal civil rights violations in investigations, in my history of dealing with them, have been jokes. Both Mary Jo White and Zachary Carter have had plenty of opportunity in the past to be able to investigate instances of federal police abuse. Mary Jo White of the Southern District of New York right now has had a grand jury sitting for over a year and a half.
She is also a U.S. attorney.
Yes, for the Southern District. And she has had a grand jury sitting. She took witnesses over a year and a half ago on some police abuse cases, and no one's heard anything about her investigation. Zach Carter took, when Ernest Seon was killed in Staten Island, choked to death while he was being arrested, he took that case under review, held it for over 6 months, and then announced that he wasn't even going to bring it to a grand jury. As a result, the Civilian Complaint Review Board was left with only a month to do their own investigation, and the statute of limitations almost ran out on their investigation. Zach Carter also dropped the ball on the Pierre Regis case, a case that I've written about extensively, of another Haitian immigrant who was nearly beaten to death by police on the night of Gavin Cato's death, the night of the Crown Heights disturbances, nearly beaten to death. He was just a person driving through the neighborhood, and police thought he was trying to run somebody over, dragged him out of his car, beat him almost to death, smashed the front windshield, the back windshield of his car. All the cops on the scene were photographed around his body, but when they were all brought into the CCRB, none of them could remember anything. Highway patrolman said that Pierre Regis was beaten worse than anything that happened to Rodney King, yet he couldn't identify any of the cops that he saw beating them. A federal investigation was launched. I spoke to some federal sources who said that all the FBI agents were pulled off to work on the Yanko Rosenbaum civil rights case. That investigation was dropped. So I have no confidence in Zachary Carter to be able to, based on his track record, maybe he'll change this time, or Mary Jo White, based on her track record of what they will do to investigate civil rights violations in the police department.
Well, Juan, right now we're joined by three people to talk about the issue of racism and police brutality. And these people are interesting because, in fact, they are law enforcement officers. We're going to start with Matthew Fogg, who is a supervisory inspector with the U.S. Marshals Service and the president of the Federal Marshals Coalition Against Racism and Corruption. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Matthew. What are you doing here in New York?
Well, I came up to support the rally, of police brutality, racism in law enforcement. And it's our motto that if we as law enforcement officers have to confront racism from our colleagues, then we say to the public, imagine what you will have to face from these same officers. So we're here now to say we in law enforcement are taking a stance against racism in law enforcement.
What is your particular experience in the Federal Marshal's Office?
Well, in the Marshal's Office, and of course in the other law enforcement agencies, but the Marshal's Office is an office that has encountered racism for a long period of time. Ever since I've been there, as a matter of fact, my first racial discrimination complaint was filed in 1984. As a matter of fact, Howard Safer was our associate director at that time, and in the U.S. Marshal's Office. We had a class action complaint, matter of fact, filed even before I came there.
Howard Safer, now the police commissioner.
That's correct. That is so true. the first class complaint was filed in 1979. That class complaint is still open today. We've now added on to the class complaint. And the racism is just continuing. Our numbers are falling right now. Our senior executive, those are the people that make policy in our agency, everyone are white. They just hired one Hispanic and no African Americans. We find that there's disparate treatment among the all across the board. I mean, when it comes down to disciplinary actions, hiring, and so forth. And this is a continuing process in our agency.
Well, Matthew Pfau, we're going to come back to you as well as a former FBI agent, Tyrone Powers, who we've had on our show before. He's now in Detroit giving a talk, who wrote a book called Eyes to My Soul, The Rise or Decline of a Black FBI Agent. And we'll also be joined by a former New York City police officer, all here today to talk about police brutality, but talk about it from within their agencies. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, and we'll be back in 60 seconds. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's daily national news magazine. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Our guest, Matthew Pfau, a supervisory inspector with the U.S. Marshals Service. We're also joined by Stephen Zanowick, a U.S. Marshals Service deputy, formerly a New York police officer, and Tyrone Powers, a former Federal Bureau of Investigation agent for 9.5 years. Before we move on, though, I just realized, Matthew, we hadn't actually talked about what the U.S. Marshals Service does. A lot of people don't even know.
Okay, the U.S. Marshals Service is primarily responsible for protecting the federal court system of this nation. That includes witness security. That includes bringing prisoners back and forth into the court system and to prison as well. And basically asset forfeitures, whatever seizures that are made in the federal government, U.S. Marshals are responsible for that.
Aren't you also involved in capturing federal
That's
fugitives?
Correct. That is 100% correct. We're also responsible for any warrants that come out of the federal court system. That's also our responsibility.
Well, Stephen Zanowick, what kind of racism did you find within the U.S. Marshals Service as a white man yourself and also a former New York City cop?
Well, in the Marshals Service, my partner, William Scott, black partner, I witnessed him being set up at a undercover operation, and other African-American individuals being targeted for, physical assaults or being set up to fail or set up to be hurt, locked up in cell blocks with known dangerous felons. Incidents like that, I had testified on behalf of African Americans, and I've been retaliated against and reprised against and actually assaulted.
I remember writing about the Bill Scott case some time ago. When you say set up, why would other fellow agents try to attempt to set him up in a situation like that?
Well, the white deputies that were there, racist, I would say, they didn't like Bill Scott for speaking up for African Americans, and they didn't want him around. And I've actually witnessed two white marshals pull out their weapons, saying they wanted to take that nigger out.
Mm-hmm. In terms of the level of tension within law enforcement in recent years, I've reported several instances, at least within the NYPD, of increasing conflicts, of racist flyers, of threats and even brawls sometimes within commands that are in locker rooms between black and white cops, usually having to do with the sense of the African Americans, Latinos, that they're being treated in a racist fashion. What's it been like in terms of federal in the Marshals Service within the ranks on this issue?
Well, this is Matthew Fogg, but I may help you out on that one. to me, I think what's happening is the picture is just race is the issue of race in law enforcement is it's always been there, but I think the people that are now heading the law enforcement departments are less sensitive to race now. For example, Janet Reno is our head in the U.S. Department of Justice, and we have written Janet Reno. We've written her letters. We've told her that there's a clear disparate impact of treatment when it came down to African Americans in the agency as well as Hispanics. Just to give you an example, in New York here, the white officers were shooting at a picture of Dr. Martin Luther King on a gun range. To me, that sends the message right there in a nutshell, if you want to say, that they just don't care. They really don't care about relations and race relations. We just recently had a gun planted in a federal courthouse near a prisoner to set up Steve Zanowicz. And,
what do you mean? Steve Zanowicz, who's sitting right next to you.
That's correct.
What do you mean?
Well, there was a gun placed in the courthouse near a vehicle. He was escorting a prisoner. He comes to his vehicle, and basically there is a gun there. He reported this. There was no investigation done. This happened several months ago, and this was right at the height of his discrimination charges and complaints in the agency. So these are the types of things. What we're saying it's getting to the point now. It's very blatant. It's something serious is getting ready to occur.
We also are joined by Tyrone Powers, who's on the telephone with us from Detroit, a former Federal Bureau of Investigation agent for 9.5 years, and before that, a Maryland state trooper. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Tyrone Powers.
Happy to be with you again.
Yeah, it's great to have you with us again. What is your response to what's going on here in New York? You were based in Maryland in the Washington area, but your own experiences within the FBI.
Yes, I am. It's appalling what happened to Abner Loima, but I can truly say that I am not surprised, because these incidents occur across this nation every day of the year. In fact, yes, as we speak, I'm sure some are occurring now. As an agent with the FBI, I was assigned at one time to look into civil rights matters, and I took several cases to the people in charge at the FBI headquarters. And on those occasions, they specifically told me that they weren't interested in civil rights matters, never have been, weren't now, and never would be, and they would only look into these matters in the case where they were pressured by the media or by public pressure. They said they had established a relationship with local police departments through the National Academy, which is at the FBI Academy at Quantico, Virginia, where the FBI bring in police officers from around the nation to create this kind of camaraderie. In fact, it was created by Hoover to do just that, to join local police with federal police. And the supervisor at headquarters specifically told me that they would find it difficult to investigate police officers and brutality cases. And so the cases continue. And as I mentioned and talked about last year and documented in Primetime Live, covered and did an independent investigation in Detroit, where Myles Green was beaten to death by two police officers, the FBI, just as they are doing in New York, opened a civil rights investigation. And then at the same time, they had the civil rights investigation going on in the FBI office. FBI agents were holding a fundraiser to pay for the defense of the police officers. So you have the FBI investigating, heading towards prosecution of the police officers, and at the same time raising money for their defense with flyers blatantly placed around the office. And you had members of the media come in to see these flyers, and they didn't care anything about it, because this is the way the system has worked, and this is the way it continues to work. The numbers indicate that. In 1996, 11,721 complaints, civil rights complaints, most of them police brutality complaints. 2,000 of them are referred. Of the 11,000, 2,000 are referred for prosecution, and less than 79 go to court. Out of 11,000 cases, 79 mm-hmm. cases, most of them police brutality cases, end up in court, and many of them, only 2% of them you end up with convictions on.
Well, in New York City, there are similar statistics. The Independent Civilian Complaint Review Board, established by City Council several years ago, precisely because the old one was ineffective, has had 20,000 complaints, and only one police officer has been dismissed from the force as a result of any of those complaints or its recommendations to the New York City Police Department. I would think, to me, any statistician would have to say that of 20,000 complaints, if only one was deemed sufficient enough to dismiss a police officer. That's almost statistically impossible to have that that few number of results from such a large number of complaints.
Yeah, I think what's important is that, and this can be verified, at the FBI Academy at Quantico, Virginia, they have a behavioral science unit. And in that unit, profiles come out of that unit. During the time that I was an agent, profiles came out of that unit, and they actually profile African-Americans in this country as a very emotional people. And the response to that, the strategic response out of the behavioral science unit, was that when issues come up like this, the beating of Abner Loima and other, the Miles Green case, that you respond to it in a fashion with press conferences, you create committees and task forces, and eventually it'll go away. The people will move on to another topic, whereas if you had a scientific response, then there would be no quitting on the issue until you came to some kind of logical conclusion. Everything would be checked out. But they realize that an immediate response of creating task force or saying the FBI are involved in the case, even with the statistics to show that nothing will probably be done, the immediate response will calm the public fears and send them on to other issues, and then in the end, nothing will be done about the case. And this is not me saying this. This is an FBI profile of what will happen in these major cases, and it comes from the Behavioral Science Unit at Quantico, Virginia, where there are individuals paid to handle what is to determine what will happen and what is the best response to incidents like this. And I'm sure over the last couple of weeks, numerous reports have come out. And the reality of the matter is, in more cases than not, they're not. We'll write about it early on. We'll talk about it on the radio. We'll talk about it on television. And then 6 months from now, we're on to another issue, and the matter hasn't been resolved. And so the thing keeps going on over and over and over again throughout the nation.
We're talking to Tyrone Powers, a former FBI agent for 9.5 years, before that a Maryland State Trooper. He's in Detroit right now. Matthew Fogg was with us from the U.S. Marshals Service. He's from Washington. And Stephen Zanowick also joins us, a U.S. Marshals Service deputy, formerly a New York City cop. Let me ask you, Stephen Zanowick, I've been wondering, since this has happened to Abner Loima, and authorities in New York have been saying, well, this clearly is not typical of the New York City Police Department, why the police do not have press conferences denouncing this? You did have the Guardians organization doing that, which is the Black Police Officers Society, sort of fraternal organization. But we didn't have any other, we didn't hear any other press conferences. Can you talk about the atmosphere in the New York City Police Department when you were there? And do you think it is impossible that something like this would happen?
I really can't comment on it. I'm not familiar with the officers speaking out at that time. I think they were restricted at that time more so than today. I know that. As far as the racism, it existed then. Again, it wasn't that widespread, but there were officers who were racist, as anywhere. In fact, I did work in the 7-0. I worked there for a period.
You worked in the in the 70th Precinct in Brooklyn, where the police officers come from that attacked Abner Loima.
Right, and that was in 1986, I'm sorry. And I did not witness things directly, but I knew of beatings that occurred, you know, on racial lines.
And what kind of pressure comes to bear on other officers who don't condone this, like you, in protesting this?
You're placed on the outside, you're ostracized, and you're attacked by your peers. You don't get choice assignments, even from your bosses. You're left basically on the outside of things. You don't know anything from the inside. You're left out from it.
One of the things that I wrote about several months ago was I was able to get a hold of a computer printout of the New York City Police Department's discipline records over the past 20 years, and was able to report that in a 20-year period in the New York City Police Department, African Americans were being disciplined, put up on charges at three times their percentage within the department, that Hispanics at 1.5 times their percentage, and women at twice their percentage within the department. But this had held steady for 20 years, ever since they started compiling these records. I'm wondering what your experiences have been, either Tyrone Powers within the FBI or within the Marshal Service yourselves, in terms of the discipline directed against minority agents.
Well, Go ahead, this is
Tyrone. I respond quickly. The statistics are the same. In fact, the federal judge Hogan in 1993 ruled that with the statistics that one out of four African American special agents in the FBI was under some kind of internal investigation, that the penalty was always more severe. And let me say this. And to me, this should give the impetus for the agents within these organizations, because I was under restricted orders not to talk to the media, not to speak out on these issues. Despite all of these orders, I think that as law enforcement officers, you must speak out, despite being restricted by the particular agencies, because when you took the oath and swore to uphold the laws of the United States of America, these are laws that are being violated, and they cannot silence you on what your job is supposed to be. In the case of the New York case, the police officers in that precinct have the absolute right and the authority to use deadly force against the police officers who was beating Abner Louima, because they're required by their oath and by their job to stop, to prevent the injury and the death of either themselves or any other civilian that's being wrongly done. So to have the police department put these restrictions on what you can say and what you can do, or the FBI do that, is counterproductive or counter to the oath that you are sworn to do. And as more law enforcement officers begin to speak up and really understand that what their calling is and what they are supposed to do, they will not be silenced even by regulations, because they are actually upholding their oath when they speak out and point these things out.
And Matthew Fogg.
And how you doing, Tyrone?
Good.
All righty. One of the other things I wanted to say, and I've come up with, I think, a semi-answer, if we could say, for this type of treatment. And I think officers, they need other officers, even in other departments, to rally around them, because you have a lot of good officers out there that want to do the right thing. I always say racism is just like cancer. I mean, you know, it can start off small, but it can destroy the body sooner or later. One of the things that I've done is I've reached out to other officers in the different departments, from Metropolitan Police, New York Police, Lieutenant Higdon, different people, Juan Espinal. Officers all around the country are contacting me. Officers from L.A., I've spoke to them. FBI agents, Emmanuel Johnson over there, who has a class action complaint now going. DEA has a class action. INS agents have called me. And what we've decided to do is we've decided to come up with an organization of law enforcement officials from all over the country, one organization. And we were discussing that this weekend, and we've decided to name it the Federal Law Enforcement Commission Against Racism and Corruption. And this organization would be made up of officers from all across the United States. Because what we have is we have a lot of satellite organizations. DEA is doing their thing, FBI is doing their thing, INS is doing their thing, Metropolitan Police, New York Police. We have these different departments all around the country, but I think we need a network of officers. And what we can do then is say to the public, we're going to speak out. We're going to speak out whenever we see racism and corruption, and we're going to cross that thin blue line, as they always say. We're going to cross that line, and we're going to bring it to the public, because I believe the public is what we need to do. We need to bring it to the public and stop being silent with this, and I think we can do something from there.
You have a website, Matthew Fogg, and I think this is important for who want to get in touch with your organization, this new national organization, but can you tell us the address?
Yes, the website address is www.bwbadge, that's all one word, B as in boy, W as in whiskey, badge, .com, C-O-M. And that website right now, we are getting a lot of traffic. We're up to, we've only been on the internet for 2.5 months, and we're up to now 5,500 hits a day. I mean, not a day, but totally. We're getting roughly 100 hits a day. We're getting a lot of comments, a lot of responses from people. I just got a response from a gentleman who's with a police department in New Zealand, telling me that he was 100% behind us, supported us. We're getting a lot of responses. Furthermore, I wanted to also say that we've contacted, and I've met with Maxine Waters, Congressional Black Caucus Chairman in Washington, D.C., myself and DEA agents who are filing a class action. She is also behind this commitment to racism, to fighting racism in law enforcement, and she's going to be having a hearing on October the 15th in Washington, D.C., in reference to this. That right now is a tentative date set for a hearing in reference to law enforcement officers experiencing racism within their departments.
Matthew Fogg, if people want to get in touch with you and are not quite net literate, is there a phone number that they can call for your organization?
Sure. They can dial area code 301-702-0666.
That's 301-702-0666. I want to thank you all very much for joining us on this day that's expected to be a massive march in New York City against police brutality. And among the people who will be there are the guests in our studio today. Matthew Fogg has been with us, a supervisory inspector with the U.S. Marshals Service and president of the Federal Marshals Coalition Against Racism and Corruption. Stephen Zanowick, also a U.S. Marshals Service deputy and formerly a New York City cop. And Tyrone Powers on the line with us from Detroit, a former FBI agent. The name of his book is called Eyes to My Soul, The Rise or Decline of a Black FBI Agent. And thank you all very much for joining us. Next up, we're going to talk to David Bradley. I spoke to him last weekend up in Vermont. He was one of the writers at the Breadloaf Writers Conference. He is a winner of the Penn Faulkner Award for his book, The Cheneysville Incident. We're going to talk about that and his meditations on race, history, and America. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman, and I'm at the Breadloaf Writers Conference just outside Middlebury, Vermont. And here a Writers Conference takes place, has been taking place for the last 71 years. The Breadloaf Inn was started in the 1800s and was bequeathed to Middlebury College and became a Writers Conference in 1921. And since then, writers and students have been gathering from around the country every summer to discuss just that, writing. I'm joined right now by David Bradley. He's an author of two books, South Street, and more recently, about 10 years ago, he wrote The Cheneysville Incident. The Cheneysville Incident has been compared to Toni Morrison's Song of Solomon and Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, and I discovered it last weekend in the Breadloaf bookstore and spent the last week with it. In fact, just finished the last few pages this morning. And a powerful book it is. It's the story of an African-American historian of white history, I guess you could say, who was reluctant to return to his own roots, but eventually did return to find out about his father's suicide, about a tragedy of escaped slaves, and basically to discover the ruins of his own heritage. I think David Bradley can probably describe it much better since he spent 10 years writing this book, and we welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much.
Tell us first about the Cheneysville incident.
Well, it's hard to describe since it's been was so many years in the making and it's been a while, but it really began with a story my mother told me about my hometown. And I was in college at that time, didn't really want to know very much about the place that I'd escaped from. But she told me about a story about 13 slaves who were escaping on the Underground Railroad, reached a point about 4 miles north of the Mason-Dixon line in what we used to call free territory before we knew better. And, you know, rather than be returned to slavery when they're about to be recaptured, killed themselves. And I was captured by that story. I was fascinated by that story. I didn't understand that story. And so I started over the years going back and trying to figure out who these people were and what they had felt, why they would do that. The graves are there on a hillside in western Pennsylvania, and that was about all we had. And so what grew out of that was a novel.
And tell us about this man, John Washington, who went to discover the story.
John Washington is, you're a very perceptive reader. He is avoiding all kinds of historical things, even by the history that he studies. But he's also trying to escape a father who was a very dominant father, let's put it that way. A moonshiner, a very strange man who had, you know, plots and machinations everywhere. A mother who was a strange person in her own right, and a background that included hiding out in the woods and hunting deer and all kinds of things that are sort of lost in the city. And when he returns, he has to recapture not only history, but all the things that he knows how to do. It's about, really about overcoming a sense of logical history and documentary history and figuring out what it is you know, what it is you believe, rather than what it is you're told or what it is you can prove.
You tell the story of one of John Washington's father's friends. His name was Joshua White. And what happened to him when he got interested and fell in love with a white young woman?
Yeah, I tell the story, but I can't tell you what it is, because it's part of the book that's ambiguous. That's one of the central questions of the novel. John Washington has a white lover, and their relationship is at a point where, you know, they either go forward or they go away. And one of the questions that always has been in my mind is, you know, where do you draw the line? Where do your politics stop? The healing process of race in this country seems to me is down to who can you love? Who will they let you love? Who will you find a way to love? And so that story that sits in the middle of the book is really one that it has a certain ambiguity about the ending. Who did what to who? What actually happened? And that's the story of the whole book. There's a lynching involved, but the question is who betrayed who? Was there love involved? We don't know.
You clearly did a tremendous amount of research, even though it is a novel, into the real facts of this country. You talk about the Klan back at the turn of the century. What did you find out?
Well, that's, you know, I did research in the sense that I read a lot of books, and it looks like a lot of research because what common knowledge is about this country is virtually non-existent. But it was, you know, if you do local history, if you talk to the people who were there, I mean, in my hometown, which is Bedford, Pennsylvania, halfway between Harrisburg and Pittsburgh, the Klan still is big. The Klan was very big in the 20s. The Klan was very big in a lot of the country in the 20s. I mean, they marched down Pennsylvania Avenue in their photographs. It's not a secret. It's not like some dusty archive. But, you know, we just tend to forget these things, and we tend to try to solve our current problems without any idea of where they came from. That's a common theme in almost everything I write.
We're talking to David Bradley. He's author of The Cheneysville Incident, also South Street, which I didn't get a chance to read. But what is South Street about?
South Street was a novel that's set on the street in Philadelphia, a street called South Street. It's the one in the song, Where Do All the Hippies Meet? And it was my first novel. But I went to college at the University of Pennsylvania, which is the other end of South Street. But although I will tell you that. And I came from a small town. I didn't know what to do with the city or anything. And I found in this place, South Street, a sort of a community. And I found it among people who, at that time, in 1968, sociology was saying was totally dehumanized, and they had no community, they had no friends, they, you know, were in a tangled pathology, as Moynihan would say. And I went down there, and I was hanging around, and you know, I met people who were just like people I knew at home, and God knows a small town is a community. And they were no different. So it was possible for me to move in that world in a way that I didn't think I would be able to, and that's what the book came from. Seeing a small town in a very large urban setting. I mean, there are other issues, of course, but I was able to find out things about people there that most people would say you couldn't find out.
In the Cheneysville incident, you talk about John Washington being a man from a black community, only really knew black people when he was growing up, and then immersed in a white world. Was that your world?
Well, no, and John's is sort of... It's sort of ambivalent. I mean, there's a town there that they're part of, but the hill on which they live is, you know, all of Western Pennsylvania is like that. There's a white town and there's a hill outside of town where the black people live. It's called the hill, usually. It's called the hill in Pittsburgh. It's called the hill in Chambersburg. It's called the hill in Bedford, although people move around. And yeah, that was very much the way I lived, except that my family was educated and my father was a preacher and so forth and so on. So we were not as much of the town as John Washington's family seems to be. But, yeah, it was more a question of going from actually, it was the other way around, to tell you the truth. I knew more about white people than I did about black people in a mass. The urban black experience was something that was totally foreign to me. I mean, I wanted to hear some of this, the music that was in Philadelphia when I got there. And I'd turn on the radio and they'd say, tickets at all the usual places. And I had no idea where the usual places were. So I had to do a lot of research in that sense. I grew up in the country, and that's one of the dynamics, I think, of this novel that goes beyond race, is that country, city phenomenon that, you know, people assume that black people have not had. That if you're rural and black, that means you're southern. And if you're urban and black, that means you're northern. And that doesn't work anymore.
What about the bondage hypothesis, meditations on race history in America that you've been writing now for a while?
Oh, boy, have I been writing it for a while. it's outtakes from the Cheneysville incident, to tell you the truth. I was never interested in history. My father was a historian. We had history at the dinner table. I wanted nothing to do with it. I only went to history for John because I needed to tell the story that could only be understood in that context. So I had to start finding out what historians did and how they thought and so forth and so on. And I found a whole lot of really wild facts that I could not use. I was looking for offbeat stuff to sort of give his character color that he would know, and found some of the most amazing stuff and came up with some actual historical theories, and I decided to play them out and see how they go. And it turned into, this book is sort of halfway between novel and nonfiction. There's an awful lot of story, but it's also an awful lot of what's wrong with us, why if so many of us, so many Americans now say we want to solve the race problem, we don't want to do this anymore, we think it's silly, it costs us money, we want to stop, why haven't we stopped? If you are black and you want to believe one of two things, you either have to believe that white people are lying to you, that they really don't care, it's true in some cases, but I happen to believe that they really do care, it's just they don't know how. And the how of it, it seems to me, lies in history, that we are prisoners of lies that we believe about ourselves as a nation. We believe things are getting better. We insist that things are always getting better. If somebody comes along and says, not in my neighborhood, we want to say, hey, no, 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 and sweep that under the rug until something like Rodney King comes along. And then everybody finds out that what people have been telling them for years is true.
What do you think are the most important lies that have to be uncovered?
Well, the first one, that things are always getting better. I mean, you look at American history, it's very clear that the fate of black people in this country is falling on the sine wave. It goes up and it goes down. It's going down right now. When I went to college in 1968, it was on the upswing, affirmative action, all that good stuff, money. It was really money more than affirmative action in my case. But over the years in between, the 30 or so years, I've seen it, you know, we have gone out of fashion again. And that's happened before. It will probably continue to happen until we find a way to stop that cycle. Each time the trough is a little lower, and each time the peak maybe is a little higher, but, you know, it varies. It varies from time. We have to accept the fact that, no, it isn't always better. The myth that black people are a monolith, that we can talk about things like the black church or the black experience, or consign everybody to 1 month out of the year and call it Black History Month or African, that we can change our name and make a difference. I mean, I've been through three name changes. I am not an African American. I can't do that. It takes up too much space. I'm black. I'm a black American. And America's going to have to get used to that idea. But those are the things that we believe. We believe all this, I call it voodoo sociology, that so many things can be solved simply when we've taken 300 or 400 years messing it up, that America is finished, that we have somehow become the nation we were designed to be, and I figure we're about a third of the way there. We have a lot of work to do. And along about 1845, people started saying, oh, it's finished, we've done it, we're a success. No, no. And that's probably the worst myth.
And where does slavery fit into the black and white experience today?
There are vestiges of slave practice. There are vestiges, more important, of the kind of mindset that allowed slavery to proceed. I mean, look at the basic problem the quote-unquote founding fathers had. We want to call this nation America, and we want to say that it is, we are the freest nation on earth. We have all these freedoms. We have the Bill of Rights. Oh, by the way, approximately 20% of the population is in chattel slavery. You talk about doublethink. I mean, this is a serious problem. And so it was necessary to create myths about who people were and what they were capable of and whether it was okay. Long after slavery, those myths are, I mean, if you read Thomas Jefferson's justifications, those are the same lies and the same advertisements that are applied to black people and saying, well, they really don't want to work. They really can't think very well. If they hear the word nigger, they will lose the ability to reason. And you hear that from strange sources. Okay, that's Thomas Jefferson. And that's the apology of a man who wrote the Declaration of Independence and held slaves. We have a problem right there.
One of the things you bring out in the Cheneysville incident is that clearly slavery was not just about the South.
Oh, slavery was just about, it was the whole country. I mean, this is the money. This is where the money came from. No nation, how do you found a nation without money? How do you found a capitalist country without capital? And slaves were America's capital. It wasn't just buying and selling. It's like the Middle East and oil. Only we had, this country had Africa, and they got slaves. And they went there and they took people for little or nothing and turned them into huge economic entities. It was a lot of money involved, which is one of the reasons why Lincoln wanted to buy them all back. I mean, Lincoln's idea of emancipation before the war was basically that he was going to put the nation into debt and buy the slaves from the Southerners and do something with the slaves, ship them off somewhere. He wasn't real clear about that. But that was the idea that the government was going to go in. Nobody knew where the money was going to come from. Seemed to me he should have given the money to the slaves because it was their free labor, but that's another story. But this is where the formative capital of this nation came from. And when we've tried to import the American system to other cultures, we've simply lost sight of the fact that unless you got capital, unless you have a large group of people that you can work very hard for a long period of time for little or no pay, you're going to have a hard time starting a country in the democratic mold. And every time somebody else starts to follow in that footstep, we get all upset. Oh, we can't, must have your human rights in this country. We're emerging. You know, we didn't have human rights. A fifth of the population had no rights whatsoever. We lose sight of that.
David Bradley is our guest. He's author of The Cheneysville Incident, South Street, and his new book that's still in progress is The Bondage Hypothesis, Meditations on Race, History, and America. The slavery apology is something that came up in the last few months from Congressman Tony Hall, saying the country should just apologize for slavery. And many white conservatives from the South in the Congress condemned this, said that's over and done with. But also, largely, the African-American community condemned it.
Well, yeah, I think so. Very good. I mean, also, I noticed that once they decided not to do it, now everybody's upset. What do you mean you're not going to apologize? I mean, it goes both ways. I think America should apologize for slavery. I just don't think anybody should be able to accept that apology. There are a lot of things we have to apologize for, and I'm not sure who to, but, you know, to say that one group is privileged to be the victim or to have, you know, and be able to say, okay, therefore you're forgiven. I mean, do we get forgiven at that point? I think it would be much more productive to actually admit what we did, to actually elocute, as they say when you cop a plea. What was slavery all about? Let's hear Bill Clinton stand up there and tell us exactly what happened and exactly who did what. He'll be there for a long time. But I think that when we get to the point of actually admitting what happened, apologies won't be necessary because the problem will be pretty much gone.
Talk a little about what happened, because you do in the Cheneysville incident, John Washington talking to his girlfriend, Judith Powell, goes through the whole history, talks about the Middle Passage and how many people died.
Yeah, I don't know if I remember the figures, but it was in the millions and probably 30, or nobody's really sure how many. But it wasn't just those people who died in the transit. There were a lot of people who died who never made it onto the boat. There were a lot of people who died in the West Indies. There were a lot of people who died here. And even if they did not die, they lived their entire life in a slavery that was worse than almost any situation in the world. We don't want to accept that, and we profited from it. All those people who were sitting in Philadelphia writing the Constitution, all the Southerners were slaveholders. The documents of this country were written by people who had the leisure time to write these, to read the books, and to, you know, they were reading John Locke and writing about it, and that was leisure time. When Thomas Jefferson showed up in Philadelphia to write the Declaration of Independence, he had four slaves with him. You just simply can't separate the labor saving device of slavery from the achievements of this country and the way that things proceeded. It can't be done. That's what needs to be said. Not who earned something or not what slice of the pie you get, but that whole pie is one thing, and we're all Americans. That means, hey, nobody's privileged, but it also means that you have to accept the reality of where we came from. It was not some manifest destiny. It was not that the Europeans were so smart. I mean, you can get a long way when you got everybody else doing the work for you.
David Bradley, author of The Cheneysville Incident, also South Street. His forthcoming book is called The Bondage Hypothesis, Meditations on Race, History, and America. The Cheneysville Incident is published by Harper and Row. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. By the way, I was speaking with him at the Breadloaf Writers Conference in outside of Middlebury, Vermont. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin. Errol Maitland engineered today's show. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. If you'd like to write to us, you can write to us at democracy@pacifica.org on the internet. That's democracy@pacifica.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!